How do we continue faithfully to confess and practice our Lutheran faith in a culture of secularism, pluralism, and relativism? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is the 2017 edition of Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation, 2017 edition. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, on the 11th of November, the church remembers a 4th century bishop named Martin. And he might be or seem to be an obscure character, but his namesake, that is probably more well-known to you. We're going to be talking about Martin of Tours that the church remembers on the 11th of November. And you've probably also heard this asserted many times. The first Christians, the ancient Christians, the original ones, maybe even the apostolic era Christians, they were, in effect, communists. Doesn't the Book of Acts say that they held everything in common? They sold their goods and distributed what was got for the sale to the poor and to anyone as they had need? Were the earliest Christians communists? And are Christians today supposed to be communists if they follow in the footsteps of those earliest Christians? Joining us to talk about both of those subjects on this Thursday afternoon, Dr. Joel Olowski, Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of the Center for the Study of Early Christian Texts at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, formerly served as the Operations Manager for the Ancient Christian Commentary on Scripture series. Joel, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
What is the Reformation connection to this 4th century bishop, Martin of Tours?
Well, it was believed that Martin of Tours was born around November 8th or 10th. It all depends. But I think Martin Luther's parents, Hans and Marguerite, knew that they wanted him baptized, and they gave him the name Martin in honor of St. Martin's Day. So they tied Luther pretty much to Martin of Tours for that reason.
So the reason we remember Martin Luther and not Hans Luther Jr. or something like that is because of the date of Luther's baptism on this
Saint's
Day.
That's right. And they choose to name it after the saint, whatever day he'd be baptized. So, and Luther himself had a son named Martin, but I don't think he was actually born on the day of Martin of Tours. So that's an interesting kind of move there. But yeah, his parents wanted to do that honor to the saint.
Was that a common practice? I know that churches were often founded on or near saints' days, received the name of that saint sometimes. Was it a common practice to name children that way?
Yeah, I think so. And it all depended, of course, on the piety of the parents. But indeed, if you were to come from a pious family, that would be the way you would name your children, as opposed to, let's say, watching a soap opera and you like this or that character. You know, it's a much more, it's a deeper way of thinking about even the identity of a child, you know, identifying him in that sense with a saint, because that's ultimately their hope for their child as well, that he would emulate the life of that saint.
This is not entirely unusual, but maybe a little rare by the time we get to the 4th century. Martin is actually born into a pagan family. Talk about his life.
Yeah, he's an interesting life, very much so. He was probably born in what we would today call Hungary. The Roman province was Pannonia, but he was born to a military family, and neither of his parents were Christians. And in fact, his dad, being a military officer, I think Martin saw that in his dad and wanted to kind of emulate him. And so he actually decided to pursue a military career himself, at least at the beginning. Some of the tradition says that he encountered Christ already when he was like 10 years old. And that's kind of interesting. But we know that he did ultimately pursue a military career for a while. And later on, through an encounter with Christ, he decided to leave behind his military career and become a monk because he felt that would be the best way to follow Christ. Interesting that Martin Luther kind of had the same thing, although his was a career as a lawyer. But you see this same kind of idea. The encounter with Christ caused him to ultimately then be baptized. And even after he was baptized, though, which is kind of interesting, he still served as a military leader, a military person for a while. But he had kind of a dramatic point where I guess it would have been, who was it, Emperor Julian the Apostate, who had was going to go into battle, and at this point Martin decided he couldn't do it anymore. But Julian wanted him still to go into battle, and he was kind of going to force him into it, and Martin said, well, you know, go ahead, put me in the front of the line, and I'll just stand there, and I believe God will protect me, but I'm not going to take up the sword anymore. Well, it turns out that ultimately, that the battle never happened because the other side decided to sue for terms of peace, so he didn't have to go through it. But he did go through with his commitment to Christ, and then became a monk, and sought to serve the church. A lot of his time was spent in Western Gaul. And, you know, we learn a lot of this, by the way, from his biographer, if you will, named Sulpicius Severus. He tells us that Martin was actually ultimately forced, it almost seems like, to become Bishop of Tours. He didn't seek this out, but the people had heard about his amazing ministry there in Gaul, where he was doing all these amazing miracles, sometimes even raising people from the dead, these kinds of things. At least that's what was in the tradition at the time. And so they had him become their bishop. But he still always led the life of a monk, you know, and he didn't like the trappings of what was happening at that time. You know, we're talking about the mid 5th century here, 4th century, sorry, when some priests, some bishops were starting to get kind of in the favor of the government and looking to, you know, seek favors from the government. Well, he pretty much tried to shun all of that. And I think he wasn't so popular then with the clergy, but he was very popular with the laity. And that's why I think how this tradition grew, that he did all these different miracles, you know, fighting against demons and protecting the orthodoxy of the church by fighting kind of secretly, even, if you will, against the Arians. He would go over where Auxentius was bishop in Milan and shore up the Orthodox there. But ultimately, what did I say? He was seen as a humble pastor who wanted to serve the church and was very popular among the people because of his humility that way.
Why was the monastic life often the first step that a man would take, converting in adulthood from whatever other vocation, in the case of Martin, from the military life? Why was the monastic life that first step for so many of these?
Well, I think they were impressed with just the idea that someone could leave everything behind and be able to devote oneself totally to God. I mean, even today we see this among people who are just kind of fed up with a lot of the secular culture's assault on human dignity and human life and looking for fulfillment and all kinds of things that end up not being very fulfilling. And so when, you know, somebody like Martin looked at the monastic life, he saw in that something where he could truly be his authentic self and really totally focus on Christ. So I would say that it was, you know, Jesus was the one who had changed his life, and monasticism to him seemed the best way to be able to devote himself totally to Christ. And, you know, when we think about this, we shouldn't think about it, you know, in Luther's reaction against monasticism, I mean, which a reaction was definitely called for in his day. But at this time, the monks were the ones who were seen as pushing against the secularity of the world that was even trying to invade the church. And so somebody like Martin was looking to get away from that kind of secular pull and really devote himself totally to Christ. And, I mean, you see the same thing with Augustine. You see the same thing with Basil and these other bishops who were really in the monastic tradition before they were kind of forced, shall we say, into the life of a bishop.
Now, this is a kind of a turning point time for the church in the Roman Empire, the early 4th century. It is a time where Christianity is transitioning from outlaw to legal religion, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, when you look at Martin was probably born around 316 or so, some of the dates say 330s, but either way, it was after Constantine had kind of consolidated the empire and at least made Christianity legal. So he was growing up at a time when he would have seen these kinds of changes in the church, but he wouldn't have known really, you know, what it was like to not be a legal religion. You know, now his dad wasn't all that keen on Christianity, obviously. It's said that perhaps even with his mother, he might have converted her to the faith later on, but he would have, you know, seen kind of that secular pull even to a large degree in his own family. But then seeing it among the clergy, I think, for him was the difficult thing. And you see more of an emphasis on catechesis and things like that as the church at large is trying to figure out how do we bring in all these converts and really train them up in the nurture and knowledge of the Lord, when some of them are probably looking you know, to involvement in the church as a way to get ahead. And the church knew that was going on, and the church knew that even some of its own bishops were confronted with this. So, you know, it was an interesting and, I think, in some ways challenging time for the life of the church to remain faithful to the gospel, even in the face of all these challenges.
Do we have any of his, any writings? You talked about a biography of him, but do we have any of his writings that survive to us to this day?
Well, if we do, I don't know about him. I mean, we very well could, but he didn't really write that much. It was more, he was kind of a doer, you know, going out and ministering among the people. And so most of what we hear about him, as I said, is going to be from his biographer. And that's where he's, you know, different than, let's say, Basil or Augustine. It really was his life that made him popular among the life of the people. So as far as writings that we have, you know, I'm not really familiar with any, except for, like I said, the one written about him by Sulpicius Severus.
Dr. Joel Olowski is our guest. When we come back, we're going to turn to the subject. The New York Times had this in the Sunday Review under the opinion section. Are Christians supposed to be communists? Many people believe that the original ones were. We'll find out if that's true after this.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Orphan Grain Train is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During November, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Orphan Grain Train. Learn more at lutheranfcu.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you. Good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Joel Olowski is our guest. Returning from the subject of 4th century Bishop Martin of Tours to something a little more contemporary, a recent column in the New York Times titled, Are Christians Supposed to Be Communists? Have you heard this before, that the earliest Christians were communists according to the book of Acts? And does that mean Christians today? Well, is it true? And then does that mean Christians today should be communists as well? Dr. Olowski, let's try and accurately describe what it is the book of Acts is saying about the earliest Christians of the apostolic era and their living in this Roman world in what looks like a communal fashion.
Yeah, very good. And by the way, this, I think, does tie to Martin of Tours, because, of course, what he was known most famous for was his giving his cloak, you know, splitting his cloak in half with his sword and giving it to somebody who was poor, and everybody around him being convicted of that, you know, just to kind of add that to it. But, of course, this article you're talking about, the one by David Bentley Hart, and this idea of communal living. And I would go back, of course, to Acts chapter 2, where they talk about that everybody had everything, you know, in common, kind of this idea of koinous or koinonia, that they shared everything and took care of each other, at least in the earliest period of the church there. And they talk about sharing the possessions. I mean, we have this in Acts chapter 4, actually. It says, all the believers were in one heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. And with great power, the apostles continued to testify and everything else that goes on from there. But it's interesting how, of course, we even get into this idea of that there were no needy persons among the Christians, because other people who came into Christianity, the more wealthy people who owned land or houses would sell them. And they would bring the money from that sale of the property and put it at the apostles' feet. And, of course, that's where we hear the whole story about Ananias and Sapphira, too, who didn't give everything back to God. But it does seem like, at least in the earliest period, that the church was charged with taking care of its own members. And it did it largely through the wealthy people who would give a portion of what they had sold and take care of the poor. So is that an accurate description? I suppose in one sense, yes. And did that tradition carry on in the life of the church? Well, it seems at least to a certain degree it did. I guess my question is whether you call this communism or not. Maybe that's partly what you're getting at as well. And I'm sure David Bentley Hart chose that provocative title to kind of get people thinking here. I wouldn't say this is the same thing as, let's say, political communism. In fact, my kids used to hear me use this term, and I didn't use it in a very flattering way, shall we say. And when they were asked about it in their social studies class, they pretty much reiterated what I had said at home, and they got in a lot of trouble. But that's another topic. You know, both of us grew up in that time, right, when communism was kind of the great Satan and all this. But the idea that we could kind of take that ideology and put it back in the New Testament really doesn't fit, in my opinion, because communism doesn't take into account the whole doctrine of original sin, shall we say, and how, you know, it's not how you could structure a whole society. And even among Christians, there still are the issues of avarice and greed and everything else that are there. But you know what? When I look at this, I think as the early church looked at it too, they saw this kind of as the ideal, though, in the sense that Christians can and should take care of one another, and it was frankly what attracted many people to Christianity. You know, but I got to be honest, they wrestled with this. You think of Clement of Alexandria, you know. He wrote this sermon or delivered this sermon called, you know, Who is the Rich Man Who Can Be Saved? The question of whether a Christian could even hold wealth. And we know of many bishops who did indeed sell everything and probably were made bishops because then they had that wealth to distribute among the poor and to help them. You know, and when Clement is thinking about this, in one sense, he realizes he's, of course, delivering this sermon in Alexandria, which was a very wealthy place. And he came to the conclusion that we do need a wealthy people, because otherwise, where is the church going to get the money, you know, to distribute it to the poor? But wealthy people will give of their wealth, and they won't let their possessions possess them, shall we say. That's kind of his message there. You get somebody else like Tertullian, who will talk about, in his apology, you know, his defense of Christianity, he talks about the common treasure chest that the church had. And this was, he said, all voluntary. People would give offerings probably just once a month rather than weekly. And they would do this, he says, to help the poor, the homeless, the orphans, you know, children who were just kind of on their own. It helped the elderly. So the church saw this as its charge, as its responsibility to care for those in need, just like Martin Tours would talk about when he helped this poor man. He then he had a dream that night that said that Christ appeared to him and said, "You helped me." And so they really did see their service, in a sense, for the poor, serving Christ as well.
With about a minute and a half here, can we take what was prevailing at the apostolic era in terms of how they lived this way. And this is, by the way, said only of the Christians in Jerusalem at the very beginning.
Right.
Can we take that and try and apply it directly to the 21st century church today, saying, well, then what we need to do is go back to that. And if you're going to be a member of this church, you got to sell your property. We're going to own everything in common in order to take care of one another. Can we make that direct application?
Well, I think it'd be kind of difficult. I mean, it's descriptive rather than prescriptive, as we say. It's describing the situation there. I mean, Jesus gives us some tough words when he does say, go sell everything you have if you want to follow me. I do know there are some groups like the Benedict Option, if you've heard about that, you know, that are kind of trying to move in this direction. But I wouldn't say it's something per se that we're called to imitate to the extent that the ex-Christians did. And yet, you know, I kind of like the challenge that's there, that this idea of caring for one another and caring for those in need. As we do this, this would be something that would be attractive to people in the life of the church. But as I also said, in that kind of communal life, you've got a lot of other things you got to deal with, too, considering how people are still infected by sin and everything else that can kind of cause difficulties, you know, if we really tried to carry this out. But I don't want to lose kind of Christ's challenge to us, you know, to realize whether or not our possessions are possessing us. And if they are, we have to take a hard look at that and take that challenge seriously. But I think the idea of a communal life, it's happened before in the life of the church, these kind of utopian societies. And usually what ended up happening is they crashed and burned because of the very reasons I talked about, of sin and everything else that enters into it. So I don't want to lose the challenge, but I also want to say, you know, go in with eyes wide open if you're going to take that challenge.
With only 30 seconds, political communism is a form of government. Had the early Christians been communists in the 21st century, they would have advocated the Roman government control the means of production, all those kind of things that come with Marxist communism. Was that ever in the mind of the earliest Christians?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, and just even looking at how they were living out that communal life, shall we say, it wasn't with regard to some institution. It was with regard to caring for other people. And, you know, the collectivization and these kinds of things, forced collectivization, is the exact opposite of what Christians talked about, which is, you know, voluntarily doing something in order to serve your neighbor. And it had to be from the heart, you know, not from compulsion that you would do this.
Dr. Joel Olowski is Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of the Center for the Study of Early Christian Texts at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, formerly served as the Operations Manager for the Ancient Christian Commentary on Scripture series. Joel, thank you again for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Todd.
The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November, is a classic. It's Luther's Small Catechism in a 2017 edition. The Catechism, of course, never changes, the Catechism itself, but the explanations that follow that have been added over time, they do change, and of necessity they change, because here in the first part of the 21st century, Christians are facing challenges like we've never faced before in the public square. That's why we have the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November, Luther's Small Catechism 2017 edition with explanation. Find out about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. When we come back, it's Issues, Etc., email and the comment line. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.